Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Zed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine welcomes Dr. Robert Mayer. Dr. Mayer is the Stephen B. Kay Family Professor of Medicine at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at the Harvard School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about your interest in colon cancer. Can you tell us how long you've been interested in colon cancer?
When I was a medical student years ago, I was undecided whether to become a gastroenterologist or to become a cancer doctor. I always thought that the diseases of the bowel and nutrition and how food is absorbed and not absorbed was fascinating. And then when I learned about the cancers that were associated with it and the progress that could be made and also the needs of our patients, putting the two together seemed like a great idea, and I've been doing this in large part since 1974.
And Bob, colon cancer is one of the most common cancers in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about the incidence of colon cancer?
There will be close to 150,000 new cases of colon cancer this year, and that will lead to about 49,000 deaths. Now, the 49,000 deaths reflects the second most common cause of cancer deaths in the United States among all the cancers we deal with. That's the bad news. The good news is that number of 49,000 is down from a level of about 60,000 from 20 years ago. So somewhere in the range of a 13% decrease in colon cancer deaths have occurred right in front of our eyes.
And Bob, can you talk a little bit about why that might be? We've all heard the word screening, and we use screening in many types of cancer, but this may be one instance where screening has really made a difference.
It certainly has. Screening is very important in cervical cancer. It's very important in breast cancer, but there is no disease in which it is as effective as it is in colon cancer. And the reason for that is that the cancers don't just develop out of the clear blue. Rather, the lining of the bowel, in the lining of the bowel, benign growths called polyps appear. Polyps occur in about half of Americans by the time they're at Social Security age of 65 or 70. And as a generality, about 90% of colon cancers emerge from polyps. Many people think that going from normal bowel to a polyp to a cancer occurs in a few weeks, a few months, maybe a year. It actually takes somewhere in the range of 5 to 6 years, and it has become clear that removing these polyps prevents cancers from occurring. And as a result, the removal of polyps, the so-called polypectomies that are performed at the time of a colonoscopy, represents the single most effective means of primary prevention of colon cancer.
So in terms of our recommendations now for screening for colon cancer, could you go over those with us?
Years ago, the most common test that was used was checking the stool for the occult presence of blood. This turned out to be an effective but not sufficiently effective approach because many times cancers don't bleed on a regular basis, and looking for blood in the stool is a means, a surrogate, if you will, for finding a cancer or even a bleeding polyp. And also, the vast majority of times that blood was found in the stool, it was falsely positive. As a result, people have looked for other tests. One intriguing test is actually an experimental approach of taking stool and extracting the genetic material from it, so-called DNA, and looking for mutations that might be present, which are often present in a colon cancer or a polyp. That probably isn't ready for prime time. Sigmoidoscopy, which means inserting a tube into the lower part of the bowel, has about a 75% accuracy rate, meaning that the majority of cancers do occur on the left side of the colon, which a sigmoidoscope can reach, but it isn't 100%. And so the two tests that right now are the most intriguing are a colonoscopy, where a small tube is inserted through the entire large bowel from the anus to the appendiceal area, the appendix area in the right side of the colon, looking not just for cancers, but looking for polyps and removing them, and an X-ray test called a virtual colonography. It's sort of a CT test of the bowel. It isn't quite as accurate as a colonoscopy. It doesn't find every polyp, but it certainly avoids the need for being impaled, if you will, by a tube that goes through one's backside. However, both of those tests, the colonoscopy and the virtual colonography, require cathartics because the bowel has to be sufficiently cleaned out. And at the present time, the colonoscopy is the preferred test because it is not just diagnostic, meaning you find an abnormality, but at the very time you find the abnormality, you can biopsy it or remove it. So it's both diagnostic and therapeutic. Nowadays, it's been recommended that for people who have no history of polyps and no family history for colon cancer, which is most of us in this country, that we start to perform a colonoscopy at about age 50. And the reason age 50 is chosen is that colon cancer usually occurs in people in their mid-60s. And so doing it earlier is probably doing too much testing. Doing it later might be missing some early lesions that could be identified and removed or cured. The notion has been put forth that if you have a completely negative colonoscopy and you don't have a family history, you probably need the test to be repeated only once every 10 years, and maybe in your whole lifetime have it done two or three times. And if it remains negative, you simply aren't going to make polyps, and that's all the testing you need. Whereas if you do find polyps, meaning you are one of the 50% of Americans who are polyp producers and have these pre-malignant growths in the bowel, and they're removed, the colonoscopic examination should be repeated every 3 to 4 years. So doing it at about age 50 and then maybe at age 60 is a dividing path between a high risk and a standard risk in individual and determines how often screening should be performed.
So, Bob, would you say that having a colonoscopy over age 50 is probably the most important thing that the average adult could do to prevent cancer?
It certainly is the most important diagnostic or screening study. There are ways that all of us can prevent the polyps from occurring. The colonoscopy is there to identify the polyps once they appear. Folks who have a diet very high in red meat, folks who are more obese, heavy than others, people who smoke a great deal, these are all people who turn out to have a greater likelihood of developing polyps and secondarily developing cancer. So there are things that we can do in our own lifestyle. There are some hints, some rather strong hints, that utilizing aspirin, one aspirin tablet each day, not only is helpful in protecting the coronary arteries from having a heart attack, but also may prevent prevent polyps from occurring. There are data that are just emerging that perhaps having a little bit more vitamin D in one's diet could be useful. So there are added lifestyle efforts that one can incorporate into our day-to-day existence that will diminish the polyp risk and the cancer risk as well.
So, Bob, when you talk about risk factors for colon cancer, we've talked about a couple of things. Could you go into a little more detail about other risk factors? For instance, are there familial cases of colon cancer? Are there specific genes associated with colon cancer that we should know about?
Yes, somewhere in the range of 15% to 25% of colon cancers occur in individuals whose families or members of their family also have or have had a colon cancer in the past. We really only understand the molecular genetics, the causation, the reasoning behind them developing this condition in maybe 5 to 6% of that 15 to 25% group, so maybe about a third or a quarter of that group. There are two syndromes that one quotes quite often. 1% of colon cancer patients, 1% of colon cancer occurs in families in which by about age 20, thousands of polyps cover the entire large bowel. That's something called familial polyposis. It is conveyed through families as what is known as an autosomal dominant, which means it very commonly is spread from one member of the family to the next generation. And essentially, everybody who develops this condition, the polyps throughout the large bowel, will develop a colon cancer generally by about age 35 to 40. Now, that's the bad news. The good news for this is that there is a blood test that can identify the carriers of this gene, even when they're teenagers, before polyps have developed, something called the familial adenomatous polyp or adenomatous polyposis gene located on one of our chromosomes, chromosome 5. And in people who have this carrier condition in early adulthood, around age 20, a prophylactic operation can be performed to remove a good part of the large bowel. In the past, that required the construction of a bag, a permanent colostomy, where fecal material would come through the abdominal wall. But there are now ways to do that through one's backside, if you will, and avoid that and greatly reduce the cancer risk. Sometimes people with this uncommon syndrome also have other associated findings, which range from bone cysts to malignancies in the small bowel to actually pigmentation in the retina, in the eye grounds. But certainly in folks who have this condition, prompt referral to a genetic counselor would certainly be mandated. The other major genetic syndrome has a lot of words associated with it. It's called hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer. It was described by a gastroenterologist and geneticist by the name of Henry Lynch in Nebraska, and it is sometimes known as Lynch syndrome. This is a condition in which people develop colon cancer in their late 30s. The cancers generally are found on the right side of the colon, meaning closer to the appendix, rather than at the part nearer to the anus. People who have this condition, particularly women, are more likely to have ovarian and uterine cancer in association with it, and men may have more prostate cancer. So those are the two genetic syndromes that we know a great deal about, but taking a family history and if other members of one's family have developed colon cancer, particularly before age 50, screening at an earlier age should be undertaken.
So, Bob, this has been a really great discussion about screening and prevention of colon cancer. We're going to have to take a break now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about the therapies for colon cancer when we come back with our guest, Dr. Robert Mayer.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer, and in Connecticut alone, there will be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they have ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery at Yale Cancer Center is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and we're here today with my guest, Dr. Robert Mayer, who joins us to discuss colon cancer. We talked a lot about epidemiology of colon cancer, Bob, in the beginning of the show. But at this point, if you're a patient, say, who's been diagnosed with colon cancer, who's had a colonoscopy that's positive for colon cancer, what are the next steps?
Francine, the first step is to be certain that this is only a single cancer. So one wants to be sure that a full colonoscopy has been performed. Once that's occurred, a CT scan of the chest and the abdomen and the pelvis is generally carried out because one wants to be certain that there hasn't been any disease spread. If there has, God forbid, been spread to the liver or the lungs, unless somebody is quite symptomatic from the cancer, one might want to think twice about subjecting them to an operation. If the cancer is located in the very far end of the colon, in what's called the rectum, one might want to consider giving patients chemotherapy and radiation therapy before an operation. So one really wants to have one's ducks in order. One wants to know what's happening, draw blood studies. But let's assume that nothing further is found. Then I think it's very appropriate for that patient to be seen by a surgeon who has experience in operating on cancers in general and gastrointestinal cancers in specific. In particular, and unless there's a reason against it, an operation should be performed.
So, Bob, is this a disease that is approached from a multimodality point of view at the very beginning?
It may be, and it really depends where the cancer is and also depends on what the extent of disease, the so-called stage, might be. Furthermore, since many people with colon cancer may be elderly, and a big operation with an incision, the types of operations that we think about where people have scars on the abdominal cavity and a long time for recovery, that may be something that it's hard for someone's grandparent to successfully endure. And now with not so-called non-invasive surgical approaches where there's really no scar, but just probes are placed into the abdomen, and this is all done with very fine technique and just as much tissue is removed and the results are just as good as the big traditional operation, it's very important that a patient be seen by a surgeon who is up to date and knowledgeable on contemporary techniques, both to enhance the cure, potential for cure, and to diminish the likelihood of side effects.
So, Bob, now that we're doing colonoscopies on everybody over the age of 50, are we finding more disease at early stage?
Well, we think we are. That's probably why the number of cancer deaths are dropping. But I think we're also finding polyps and removing the polyps. I think both of those factors come into play. Clearly, if we find a cancer that has not invaded deeply into the wall of the bowel or has not spread to the adjacent regional lymph nodes, then the likelihood of cure with surgery alone is well over 80 and probably over 90%. If, on the other hand, the disease has spread to the lymph nodes, and the only way one knows that for certain is after the operation is performed, but if that turns out to be the case, without further treatment, the likelihood of cure is only 50 to 60%. That's the very setting where a medical oncologist might very well recommend prophylactic post-operative, or the jargon that's used, adjuvant chemotherapy for several months. And that approach has increased the likelihood of cure for these people from the 50 to 60% range to about 70, 72%, which is a major step forward.
So, Bob, could you clarify for our listeners, in patients who have had surgically resected colon cancer, which of those patients require adjuvant therapy and which of those patients will do well without the additional chemotherapy?
I think the first issue is, was the tumor from the rectum or was the tumor from inside the abdominal sac, the peritoneum, that tissue, that wrapper around the abdominal cavity? When it gets infected, we call it peritonitis. If it's in the rectum, which is deep in the pelvis, we often offer radiation therapy and chemotherapy, even if lymph nodes have not been involved. For the rest of the abdomen, for most patients who have no evidence spread of the tumor to lymph nodes, we generally, not always, but generally think that the surgery, if it's a good operation with an adequate sampling of lymph nodes, is all that a patient might need. Now, that's not for everybody, but for the majority of patients. Every patient with spread to a lymph node or more should be strongly considered as being a candidate for receiving 6 months of prophylactic or adjuvant chemotherapy.
Could you go through just briefly for us what the adjuvant therapy entails?
The adjuvant therapy nowadays entails the administration of three drugs. One is a very traditional and older drug, something called 5-FU, or the chemical name is 5-fluorouracil. That's a drug that we've had available for 50 years. The efficacy of that drug has been enhanced when a vitamin or a vitamin-like molecule similar to folic acid, something called folinic acid or leucovorin, is added. So 5-FU and leucovorin for many years was the standard adjuvant treatment given once a week. But more recently, adding a third drug called oxaliplatin seems to enhance the likelihood of cure, make the treatment more effective. This combination of drugs is usually given every 2 weeks for a total of 12 treatments over 6 months. We're not certain that the 6 months is chiseled marble, and there is soon to be an effort throughout the United States to determine whether 12 weeks, 3 months, is as good as 24 weeks, 6 months. And my own suspicion is that less will be as good as more, and that we'll be able to find the same very encouraging results with 3 months of therapy.
What are the side effects of this therapy? What will a patient experience during the course of this treatment?
The major side effect will be neuropathy. Neuropathy is a fancy word that means pins and needles in the fingers and toes. And why that is the most common side effect is because the other possible toxicities that are associated with this treatment, such as nausea and vomiting, such as low blood counts that could make somebody prone for infection, can be controlled very nicely with prophylactic medication. The ability to control cancer cancer chemotherapy-related nausea and vomiting has grown and increased and developed in a wonderful manner so that patients now eat lunch while they're getting their chemotherapy and don't even know what the nausea and vomiting is about. The low blood counts can be prevented in people who are prone to it with a stimulant to the bone marrow. So the neuropathy, which is pins and needles in the fingers and toes, is the major concern. This develops in somewhere in the range of 40 to 50% of patients. Within 6 to 9 months of the completion of treatment, it's resolved in 3/4 of them, but there are still a small percentage, a definite percentage of patients who have received this potentially curable form of treatment, who have as a long-term reminder of that treatment, numbness in their feet when they walk, and a loss of touch sensation in their fingers, which make working on a word processor or perhaps playing the piano or some other tactile activity a bit more difficult than it was before. So it's a matter of balancing the potential risks and the potential benefits. In the sense of somebody who has a large number of lymph nodes involved in colon cancer, there's no question that the benefits outweigh the risk. For one involved lymph node, it's a marginal decision, and that's something that I would very much encourage all our listeners, if they're in that position, discussing openly with their physician, their oncologist.
And Bob, you've been involved and at the forefront of a lot of this research on a national level now, and I think one of the major advances in colon cancer has been this recognition that there really is a benefit to adjuvant therapy, as you've said, even though there are some downsides for the patient.
Absolutely. I think there are two major steps forward. One is the better treatment and the adjuvant treatment, but I want to get back to something we talked about earlier, and that is the notion that has now been embraced by the medical community and the public in the United States of the importance of screening. And I especially want to acknowledge the courage of Katie Couric, who underwent a colonoscopy on national television, and some scientists, some epidemiologists showed that the frequency by which the American population underwent colonoscopy screening rose immediately thereafter. So we've learned a lot more about what causes the disease. There are lifestyle changes we can do to prevent it. We know that there are certain families that are more prone. We have better screening tests, and we have better ways to treat the disease. So on the one hand, it's not surprising that the number of deaths have dropped by 13 or 14%. On the other hand, the challenge that we all have is to make certain that that decrease in the number of deaths continues, because there's every reason to think that the present 49,000 deaths a year from colon cancer can be reduced by at least another 50% in the near future.
So, Bob, what about those unfortunate individuals who have metastatic disease or who have relapsed disease and don't respond to their adjuvant therapy?
Or people who were given the adjuvant therapy and their disease recurred. There are alternative forms of treatment. There are different forms of chemotherapy. There are the use of targeted so-called monoclonal antibodies directed against the formation of new blood vessels that feed tumors, particularly metastatic tumors, tumors that have spread. There are monoclonal antibodies that block sites on the cell, almost like putting your auto key into the ignition, that when it's turned on, get the engine going, get the cells dividing, make the cancer spread, and there are ways of blocking that. The most common site where colon cancer spreads is to the liver, and there have now been several reports where one can give chemotherapy to people with spread to the liver. The liver spread shrinks, that area can be surgically removed, and these people can be cured. On the other hand, most people who have metastatic disease will eventually succumb to their illness. in the past, that mortality time might have occurred within 6 to 12 months. Now it occurs much later. People live 24, sometimes 36 months. So even in this situation, the lifespan can be prolonged, and our challenge is to identify newer and more effective treatments fashioned directly for a given patient's tumor by the biological characteristics of the tumor so as to enhance the cure to a greater extent than we already have.
And so personalized medicine is going to be applied, and it even is being applied to colon cancer patients as we speak.
Absolutely. There are blood and genetic tests that are called biomarkers. And these biomarkers are teaching us in the most sophisticated manner which patients the disease is going to act badly, which patients the disease is going to respond better to treatment X versus treatment Y, which patients don't need any treatment at all, which patients might require some experimental form of therapy because standard therapy is unlikely to benefit them. This is a brave new world that has begun as the laboratory work of the last 20 years has really come to the clinic, to the doctor's office, to the bedside. But I really hope and expect that this progress is going to continue full force in the years to come.
So, Bob, it's really been terrific having you on the show tonight talking about colon cancer therapies, and it sounds like we could easily have another whole show talking about some of these new approaches. This is Dr. Francine Foss. Until next week, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.